On Friday, we had this super-duper brief introduction to the topic of amino acids. Section 2, you'll be learning more about assembling amino acids together. Because the reason we're learning about amino acids is because they're the constituents of proteins, which are very important biological molecules. So your lab section 2 that you're beginning today has to do with joining two amino acids. So that discussion of joining amino acids is going to happen in lab. Here, we're going to get into the behavior of amino acids a little bit, and we'll talk about sequencing, which is determining the order of amino acids in one of these proteins, also known as a polypeptide. So we'll, section 2, have a small discussion of stereochemistry in lab today as well, but here, just to have done it, I want to talk about the different classes of amino acids that are out there. And even though this is a repeat of some of the material that you will hear this afternoon, section 2, just to give us some context, let me show you that this is the structure of the common alpha amino acids. So by convention, we write the carbonyl group up top, just like we do for carbohydrates. By convention, whatever R group or side chain is there, which this is where we're going to start off this discussion, the kinds of side chains that could exist. By default, they're written in the vertical orientation. And so the amino group ends up either on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of this Fischer projection. And when oriented in the left, this is known as an L amino acid. There are the 20 common amino acids that are listed in your text. As I might have already commented, there's actually more than that now. If I remember, the other three are sulfur and selenium analogs of other amino acids, and they're often found in what are known as extremophiles, bacteria or other critters that can only exist in conditions which otherwise are not conducive to life, but these creatures have adapted over time. And part of that adaptation may be in the way that they've incorporated some of these quote-unquote non-standard amino acids. There are also what are known as the essential amino acids. Which, what are essential amino acids? Does everyone happen to know from their bio classes? Yeah. There are amino acids that we cannot ourselves synthesize, or a couple of them, they're kind of borderline cases where, yeah, you can do it, but it's kind of tough for the body to do, or I forget which one it is, but there's one that I think is, what is it, easy for adults to synthesize, but not children, so it's kind of got an asterisk by it, but the essential definition of essential amino acids are those amino acids that the body is not able to produce or produce easily. It must be supplied by other sources. Which means food. So again, there are 20 most common amino acids. And it is this set of 20 that you will need to memorize. I myself will be memorizing these. So in fact, I'm going to try to wing it a bit. I've got the notes here next to me in case I make a mistake. But I want to try to do a representative example just to force myself to learn. And I am trying to wing this because I've only read through these once. So I want to see what I can retain on one exposure. So the first class is of alkyl substituents, which section one, you saw a small selection this morning already. And so I'll give you the simplest one. And And section two will have more of this discussion later, but there are two ways that you can write this. One in which the amino group is in the plane of the paper, one in which the R group is in the plane of the paper. Since we're about to compare different R groups, the rest of the structures I'm going to draw like this second one, so that that R group can be more clearly seen by putting it in the plane of the paper. But then again, we'll see for section two that there are times where it's far more convenient to write it with the amino group in the plane of the paper. So this is L-alanine. Do be careful, we've already had the mix-up once, which was kind of cute, it was called aniline at some point. But that's all right. You now know the difference. The next step up would be an alcohol-containing group, which cysteine, which is a methyl group with an OH for the R group, not cysteine, serine, sorry, looks like this. So methyl and then an OH group coming off of it. Then that is L-serine. I was confusing it with cysteine, which is the sulfur analog. So if we have a sulfur-containing one, same size structure as serine, but with the sulfur instead. So that is L-cysteine. There are some amino acids that themselves have a second acid group. And with the time we have probably for today, we're going to talk about acid-base properties of amino acids. That's why we had that whole acid-base lecture a week or change ago. So R will be containing a carboxylic acid group. And our simplest example of that is going to be aspartic acid, which is to have one carbon and then carboxylic acid as our side chain. Go back and highlight what the R groups are. And let me also make sure I'm doing this right. Let's see. Methyl for alanine. Methyl and OH for serine, methyl and SH for cysteine, methyl and carboxylic acid. So you notice that these first four examples all have a methyl group as an R group, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, they have hydrogen, OH, SH, carboxylic acid attached. So if there's any kind of system whatsoever, this is one way, which I have to admit, I hadn't listened to it, but Deepika, weren't you the one that sent me the link for how to memorize the 20 amino acids? Have you looked at it your own self?
Yeah.
Is it effective? It's pretty good? Okay, I'll make myself watch it today and then push it back out. It's already on the Facebook group, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you have to memorize the one letter abbreviation.
No. And you don't have to, no. So already had tackled that for section one. Since you brought that up, there are three-letter and one-letter abbreviations for all these amino acids, but you do not have to memorize those. You only need to know the name and the structure. Okay? So then we have, let's see. There's an amide version of this. This is aspartic acid. So what if the amino acid itself contains an amide? So we make an amide version of the same amino acid we had just before, and that's asparagine. And yes, it does have something to do with asparagus. Gesundheit. Guess that's an asparagus allergy right there. K, Okay, then we have amino groups. So I showed you one that has a second acid group. I'll show you one that has a second amino group, and that is lysine. So lysine is a little different. It has four carbons, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the amino group as the R group. So let me double check. That means there should have six carbons total. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yes. So that's lysine. Got to be careful pronunciation-wise to distinguish between lysine and leucine, which is just an alkyl R group. Section 2, you'll see leucine this afternoon. Back to a pattern again, because I was trying to give you things that were structure-related. There are some benzene-containing. Oh, and I didn't even name this one. R equals amine-containing. Here, R equals benzene-containing. By far, the simplest one of which is phenylalanine. So alanine was when you have just a methyl group. Phenylalanine means, as it says, add a benzene ring to the methyl group of alanine. And then the last amino acid category are for amino acids that contain heterocycles, which means rings that do not just have carbon as one of the atoms in the ring. And the best example of that is going to be proline, which has a 5-membered ring. And notice that means that it is a secondary amine, which means proline has a very different chemistry than the rest of the amino acids. So there's your 8 classes. Any questions up to this point? I know all that we've seen is, well, here's some amino acids. But any questions yet? Okay, I think that the very first lecture we had at all on amino acids was where I described how they can exist in a cationic form, an anionic form, and then a neutral form, which we could also call the zwitterionic form. So let's have a little more in-depth discussion of that, because we want to talk about this thing called the isoelectric point. Which is the pH at which an amino acid appears in the greatest percentage in its neutral form. And here I am going to cheat and look, because I don't memorize and I don't require that you memorize these numbers. But if we had something like alanine, for example, and by the way, do not ever require you to memorize these pKa values, but pKa1, which by convention refers to the acid dissociation, that is equal to 2.34 for this alanine, And then pKa2, which is what refers to the amino group, or I should say the conjugate of the amino group, that is equal in this case to 9.69. Now, at pH 2.34, what can be said about the forms of this amino acid that exist in solution? Yes?
The conjugate has the same concentration as this form itself.
That's right. Well, actually, not this form. Oh, no, you're right. Yes. The conjugate of this molecule. We would need to specify the acid conjugate, because at pKa 2.34, that's right. This that I've written here is the neutral form of the amino acid. As we start to go more acidic, because realize pH 2 is low, you're actually going to have that amino group protonated. So although I've written this in the neutral form, that is correct. But the conjugate is therefore going to be this. The amino group has one more proton. If we write it in neutral form like this. Now, something doesn't feel right about that, though. Can't I? So it's less confusing if I do it this way, sorry. Let me write it as the Zwitter ionic form, because even myself, I was getting confused the other way. So same molecule, but it's going to make more obvious sense when you see it this way. Because I got to make sure that we know that it is the acid proton that comes off according to that particular pKa value. So even if we could say, oh yeah, neutral form, that's the same thing, it was kind of odd seeing NH2 versus NH3, even though it was the acid proton dissociating. So this is the correct statement that Emerson had said, that the neutral form, which is the Zwitter ionic form, will be in equal concentration with its cationic or acidic form. What's going to be true then at pH 9.69? There's another proton that comes off, and there is another half equivalence point effectively going on here. See, the jump in logic, how Emerson was able to do this for this first relationship, pKa equals 2.34. Remember that we did go through this long acid-base discussion to be able to say that when the pH is equal to the pKa, that you have roughly 50-50 mix of the acid and its conjugate. That is true at 2.34. If we're talking about starting with the cationic form, that is true at 9.69 if we're starting with the neutral form. So we'll again have the neutral form show up in this relationship. But now since we're going to more basic conditions, we're talking about that amino group now truly getting deprotonated and ending up with the anionic form. So essentially at the first pKa, we have that neutral is equal to the cationic, and at the second pKa, the neutral is equal to the anionic. Now here's a kind of a logical thought. If at the first pKa value, if your pH is there, you're 50-50 one way. If you go to the higher pH to match that second pKa, you're 50-50 the other way. So where do you think you maximize just having the neutral compound? In the middle of those two, right? It would seem to make some kind of essential logical sense. And that is exactly related to this graph that we generated as the first thing that we discussed with amino acids. We had mole percent or mole fraction as our y-axis. We had pH as our x-axis. We talked about how if we started at low pH, that we're going to have essentially just the acidic form of a molecule that eventually disappears. As that acidic form deprotonates, then we end up with the neutral form, which is going to reach some maximum value, and then if you get too basic, itself decrease again. And after you've pulled off the first proton, then the next association is going to make the basic form of the amino acid. Well, at these points where there's a crossover, I didn't do it very well on this graph, but that should be right at the 50% point. And so at that pH, that corresponds to pKa1. And at the appropriate pH, that corresponds to pKa2. That's how we can actually find these crossover points, knowing the pKa values. So at the first pKa, which was 2.34, at that pH, we have 50-50 acidic and neutral. At the next pH value of 9.69, we have 50-50 neutral and basic. And as you can see, right in between, that's the maximum amount of the neutral form. And so in carboxylic acids or amino acids like this, the pI is equal just to the average of the pKa values. To help hand wave this equation, imagine that you were trying to deal with two simultaneous equilibria, the dissociation of one proton and then another. If you wanted to come up with some overall expression like that, then you would be multiplying equilibrium constants. Remember, if you're adding logs, that's the same thing as, in log form, multiplying things together. So there's kind of a correspondence there that, for those of you who are mathematically oriented, might be able to see. For everybody else, here's the pretty graph. So, short version of this, there's a pI, which is the pH at which you have this maximum amount of the neutral form, and for simple amino acids that just have one amino group, one acid group, you can figure out the pI by averaging the acid strengths of those two groups. That was a little bit more compactly stated. Maybe I'll write that down in word form. For simple amino acids that do not have, as your book calls them, ionizable side chains. We'll see what that means in just a moment. For these kinds of acids, amino acids, the pI is simply the average. Of the pKa's of the acid and ammonium groups. I say ammonium because we can't say amino because that's already a base. What we mean is the protonated amino, which that's called ammonium. Now, what happens if we have something like lysine? I switched to doing aspartic acid. So let's rewrite the structure of aspartic acid. Aspartic acid is methyl group with carboxylic acid on it. And it's got three pKa values to it. pKa1, which still refers to the acid group, is 2.09. pKa2, which still refers to the amino group, the conjugate, that's equal to 9.82. pKa3, which the third value always refers to the side chain, happens in this case to be equal to 3.86. Now, what this means is that there are four forms of aspartic acid. Let's write those out. So, the most acidic form is going to look like what I've already written. But it'll be zwitterionic. And we'll have a positively charged nitrogen. No, I'm sorry, the most acidic form won't be deprotonated even. There we go. Because we should, yes, have an overall cationic molecule when it's fully protonated. Now, take off one proton from this, which is going to be the first proton that comes off? Is it going to be the main amino acid, or the main acid group on the right? Is it going to be the side chain on the left, or is it going to be the protonated amino group itself? The acid group on the right, why is that going to be the first one to lose a proton? It's the strongest acid, pKa 2 versus 4 versus 10. 2 is a stronger acid, more easily dissociates, so the first proton dissociates is the one on the right. Which here is your neutral form, notice. And that so far is kind of like a typical amino acid. But now if we lost one more proton, where is it going to come off of? The side chain, because it's got the second highest pKa, sorry, second lowest pKa value. Low value, strong acid wants to dissociate. So the next form, keeping track, we have cationic here. We have zwitterionic here. Which we can say neutral. We take off one more proton, it's going to be from that carboxylic acid side chain. So this is the anionic form. And if we got it in basic enough conditions, eventually that amino group gets deprotonated. What would I have ever done without this stuff? Now this is anionic, but it's got a double charge on it. So pi, though, still refers to the point at which we have the maximum amount of the neutral amino acid. Why do we care so much about that pi point? Because that pH is going to be closer to biological pH than either of the functional groups by its own self. Which, since each of these amino acids has slightly different pKa values, there's slightly different proportions of each of these amino acids at any given pH, but including physiological pH. So if you notice, there was a note in your textbook that when it lists the 20 main amino acids, it draws them in the form that predominates at pH 7.2. And we're going to learn in a minute how to determine what exists more of in terms of which of these forms for a given amino acid at a given pH. But that's why we're learning about these PI values, because the form an amino acid exists in determines what charges it has on it, which means it determines how it interacts with other amino acids that might be near it, which means it affects protein folding once you start letting these things do their thing in solution. So if PI is still supposed to be the point at which you have the maximum of the neutral form, well, which pKa values would I use to arrive at that? Because pKa 1 governs this first interchange, pKa 3 the second, and pKa 2. Adding emphasis to the pKa values that I wrote up here, pKa 209 means comes off first because it's the strongest acid. This comes off last because it is the weakest acid. So before, when we were trying to calculate PI, we looked at the acid group and the amino group. We have two acid groups now. As we can see, the neutral form happens between those two. So the PI is pKa1 plus pKa3, their average, not pKa2 this time. A similar thing would happen if we had a molecule like lysine. Lysine is two amino groups, and so the PI would be pKa2 plus pKa3, the average of the strengths of the conjugates of the amino groups, because that's where the anionic form or the neutral form would lie. So, what do we come up with the numbers as being? PI for this particular compound, aspartic acid, is 2.98, and the PI of alanine, let's see, 2.34 and 9.68 is 12.13, which means it'll have a PI of 6.07, right? Which we'll do something with those numbers in just a moment. So I just went over this PI concept. Where do we have the maximum amount of a neutral amino acid? Do we have any questions? May I inquire how many people have read this chapter? 10 minutes before class is still 10 minutes before class. So I'll take it as a yes. I would encourage you to start. There's a lot of chemistry in there. There is no quiz 3. Yeah, section 2 hadn't heard that, so let them absorb that for a minute. There is no quiz 3. You know, let's put them under a hypertonic solution, see how long it takes it to osmose. There will be no quiz 3. Now, may I make fun of you one more last time for the recording's sake? Because the response was, what happens to those points? Right? Which was...
I just want to point out that is not how I sounded.
That is not at all how she sounded like. But that was the intensity of the thought in her head. And if not in hers, in somebody else's. So the answer is that you will just be given those 34 points that you otherwise would have. I will bring up, for the recording's sake, another issue. We may have to cancel class Friday because... Oh, look at the sad squish, squish, the faces there. Because I cannot get substitutes for just 1 or 2 hours of missing class, because that's been a long-standing budgetary issue. I'm missing Friday because we're interviewing all day long. Yes. And so I can't miss it unless I want to. I mean, if I want to be on that hiring committee, I have to miss class. I'm going to edit that out. So, but that is the reason the class would be getting canceled. La, 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 la. All I'll say in response to that, all I'll say is, who came up with the chili peppers on Rate My Professor? Because some of those people with chili peppers, I don't get it. And I'll just, we'll just leave the names out, but still. So, I will find out if we're going to be allowed to get substitutes or not, but because that's when I was thinking of giving the quiz, then we're just not going to have the quiz. So, just warning you. So, no questions I'm taking on the ICE electronic point because it makes total perfect sense that none of you have questions about it, right?
What chapter is it?
The one on amino acids. I don't know. All this is, except for the pKa values I looked at, this is all from memory, so I don't know which chapter this is. Yes. What does the graph look like for this one? It's got three cross points instead of two, so doing it really quickly, it would look something like this. Right? It's very similar to the first graph. It's just got three crossover points because you have four forms of the amino acid that you're dealing with. Now let's talk about one use of this. Let's say that we have a mixture of L-aspartic acid and L-alanine. Just as a quick double check, for section one, if I were to say D-alanine and D-aspartic acid, how would that affect the pKa values? For section two, if you don't know it yet, because there's only one stereocenter, amino acids are ephemeric. And there's one that's called the L form and one that's called the D form, just like sugars. But there's only one stereocenter, so they're easy to make mirror images of. The L form is the biologically active one, and what I asked, though, is what would happen to the pKa values if I use the D form instead? Same, because they're enantiomers, and every physical property of enantiomer is the same except optical rotation. So it's not a trick question, but just making sure we know that. So let's say we had a mixture of those two. How could I separate them? Make one neutral, and then do what? Electrophoresis. Isn't that a bio topic?
Yeah.
Yes. How many of you have done an electrophoresis? And with the ninhydrin that you put on to make everything turn purple afterwards? Okay. Given the short amount of time we have, I'm going to jump to this ninhydrin mechanism. This ninhydrin mechanism. Okay. That conveys the fact I want you to know this then. So we are going to be getting to what electrophoresis is, but we have too little time for me to do it justice. So we'll talk about ninhydrin, which I have just enough time to do it injustice. Ninhydrin is a triketone, a trione. That technically exists in equilibrium with a hydrate form. Now, I used to know the story as to why this particular carbonyl forms the hydrate. I'll go relearn the story to tell you all. But since your book does show this equilibrium, I at least want to acknowledge it, that yes, it's there. So, the ketone form, if it encounters any amino acid, which I'll simplify and not show stereochemistry, because as you'll find out, it won't matter what the stereochemistry is. You go through series of protonate open attack the protonate or a variation thereof, and we make an imine. Which, saving time, cutting quarters, not showing every single step, which, yes, if I'm taking simplifications, you'll be allowed to as well. Otherwise, there won't be more than two questions on the exam, because you'll never have time to answer the rest of them. Turns out that this will undergo a decarboxylation / pseudo-tautomerization. So, in other words, this... Oh, I know, that's a lot of big words floating around, right? You'll be able to sound like Star Trek soon, you know, when you talk about the phase discriminator of the flux capacitor. And... So, this decarboxylates, this bond kicks on over to the nitrogen, which kicks on over to the carbonyl, which pushes the carbonyl open. Which you then have hydrolysis occur. Again, not worrying about every single step, let's just recognize that, yes, right now, that's an enol. Oh, and it's also missing a carbonyl. It's an enol, so it is going to tautomerize, reform the ketone up top. At the same time, if we let it keep hydrolyzing, we do have an imine. So even though we formed an imine, we can also unform it. Because remember, these protonate open attack deprotonate mechanisms are reversible. So we hydrolyze. Which means we end up with... a derivative of ninhydrin. But notice, the R group, which identifies the amino acid, is no longer present. So why are we using this reagent? Well, you don't really get the full context because I've jumped to the middle of the story. But this electrophoresis technique is one in which you can separate amino acids based on their charge. But once you separate them, you have to visualize them, because the amino acids themselves aren't colored. Or if they are, they're various shades of clear or brown or yellow or something. Which, diluted and put onto the paper used in electrophoresis, you can't see them. What I'm about to show you is a complex that forms due to ninhydrin, that's very brightly purpled in color, forms a complex called Roux-Menz purple. And that's the purple that forms on these electrophoresis plates once you treat it with ninhydrin, so you can see where the amino acids were, even if you can't identify by the color which amino acid it is. But once we see this technique in full on Wednesday, we'll know the position of the amino acids, which can use that to identify them. Or we'll talk about the next most complicated technique, which is chromatography. There we'll use ninhydrin again as a visualizing agent to know when it's been eluted, brought off of a chromatography column. But for those of you who recognize the name, Kevin, there's Beer's Law, which, if you remember, for Chem 1B, lets you relate the absorbance of a solution with its concentration. So we'll be using ninhydrin for that as well. To finish off the discussion of ninhydrin, though, once the amino acid reacts and you have this chain reaction hydrolysis that occurs, there's still ninhydrin left in solution, which reacts with the amino derivatized ninhydrin that just got formed, and that's what ends up causing the formation of this complex. And again, all the amino acids that react with this form this particular complex. And this is, again, Ruhlmann's purple. So I showed you this reagent, this mechanism, which if you haven't read the chapter, you still don't know what it's for. Which I'll tell you that part of the story on Wednesday. Now, section two, when you come up to lab, we're going to have a lab lecture first that is both lecture and lab, so you can know which notes to have prepared. Are there any questions before we wrap up here, Ben? Yes?
For the derivative of the menhydrin, is that a ring beside the benzene ring, or is it just barely open? No, that was about the noble R group.
I'm just showing that where there had been an R group previously, there isn't anymore.
No, the left hand side of the.
That is in equilibrium with ninhydrin itself. This is the hydrate form.
Is this the ring two?
So that's a five-membered ring,
oh.
And a fuse to benzene. Any other questions? Okay, session two, see you in lab.